From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Winston Churchill described Europe as a rubble heap after World War II, warning that a continent of starving, destitute people would become a breeding ground of pestilence and hate. Across the Atlantic, President Truman shared that fear that if Europe didn't recover quickly, more people would die of hunger and cold, civil wars would break out, and communism would step in. So Truman's Secretary of State George Marshall created the Marshall Plan, a massive humanitarian aid and reconstruction effort widely praised today. But our guest this hour, author Ben Steele, says getting this plan in place was a huge struggle. And his book includes new information about this, including a crafty U.S.-Soviet diplomatic game concluding with a Cold War that still echoes today. A new look at the Marshall Plan today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. And Ben Steele joins us from New York City. And Ben, welcome back to The Exchange. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me again.
So when we think of the end of World War II, we think of people celebrating and hugging and kissing in the streets. But how bad was it in Europe post-war, Ben? What did Europe look like?
It was awful, truly awful. The New York Times described Europe after the war as, quote unquote, the dark continent. Of course, there was massive physical devastation from the fighting. But what was less visible was even more important. There was a complete breakdown in economic relations across countries in Eastern and Western Europe. And as a result, there was really mass hunger and in some cases outright starvation in many major European cities like Vienna. There was also in many countries a complete breakdown in law and order as different political and ethnic groups took retribution against each other. And as a result, there was a real desire in the continent for massive political change. And part of that reflected itself in the rise of very powerful communist parties in many European countries, in the case of Western Europe, in Italy and France in particular. And this, as you can imagine, was of great concern to the Truman administration.
Well, and we'll definitely talk about that. I'm glad you mentioned, though, that, you know, in addition to the fundamentals, starving, having no place to live, having no job, Europeans weren't feeling that good about each other. I mean, some had collaborated with the Nazis or at least looked the other way. So just remind us about that post-war violence and retribution.
Yeah, if you consider France during the war, for example, the Germans had a very, very small occupation force in France. So most of the country was actually ruled by collaborating Frenchmen. So after the war, as you can imagine, there was an enormous desire for retribution against their compatriots who had carried out Nazi policy in their country. And this was of extreme concern to the State Department, the fact that law and order had completely broken down in many parts of Europe.
Yeah, lots of street justice, so to speak. In Italy, you write, for example, 20,000 suspected collaborators were murdered following the fascist defeat in 1945. So that just gives you a sense that, you know, Europeans are not linking arms and saying, you know, brother, so nice to see you now that this war is over.
No, they're not. They're focused on getting their due for what they saw as injustices committed against them by, as I said, in many cases, their own compatriots.
So as you said, you know, Harry Truman, Secretary of State George Marshall, look at this political upheaval, starvation, people dying of cold. And they say, whoa, this is problematic. I want to play a little clip, Ben, of President Truman, knowing that Americans were weary of Europe and its troubles. But here he is speaking before a joint session in Congress of Congress in 1947. And he presents this idea of economic aid as an investment in American national security. Let's hear.
The seeds of totalitarian regimes are nurtured by misery and want. They spread and grow in the evil soil of poverty and strife. They reach their full growth when the hope of a people for a better life has died. We must keep that hope alive. The free peoples of the world look to us for support in maintaining their freedoms. If we falter in our leadership, we may endanger the peace of the world, and we shall surely endanger the welfare of this nation.
So there you have it, President Truman saying, look, I know we're all sick of Europe, but it's kind of up to us. How did the American people feel about that, Ben?
Well, the American people desperately wanted to disengage from Europe.
Sure.
As Undersecretary of State Dean Acheson put it in 1946, the American public was telling the Truman administration two things. First, bring the troops home. And second, don't play Santa Claus. They'd had enough of Europe after two major world wars in the course of a quarter of a century. And this was the big problem for the Truman administration. After the end of the fighting in Europe in May 1945, there were over 3 million American troops in Europe. And Truman, who had only been in office for 1 month, was determined to carry out FDR's pledge made at the Tehran Allied War Leaders Conference in 1943 to bring all U.S. troops home within 2 years. So if they were going to reestablish law and order and a basic standard, decent standard of living in Europe, they were going to have to do that without a massive occupation force.
So the American people say, bring the boys home. Don't be Santa Claus. So there's this effort, which you describe in the book. It took a long time to get the public, to get Congress on board with this thing we now call the Marshall Plan. I want to play another clip, Ben. This is Secretary of State George Marshall himself testifying before Congress. And he acknowledges in this clip hesitation by Congress, by the American people. But he also makes the same national security argument that President Truman makes. Let's hear.
To be quite clear, this unprecedented endeavor of the new world to help the old is neither sure nor easy. It is a calculated risk. It is a difficult program. And you know far better than I do the political difficulties involved in this program. But there's no doubt whatever in my mind that if we decide to do this thing, we can do it successfully. And there's also no doubt in my mind that the whole world hangs in the balance as to what it is to be.
Okay, so that's Secretary of State George Marshall. So what about that, Ben? The new world helping the old is a risk. I think somebody in the book describes it as, you know, a banker looking at a loan application from someone who's gone bankrupt several times. It didn't look good.
A huge risk. Nothing like this had ever been tried in world history. And these ideas, interestingly enough, were coming from the American military. Not from the economic establishment, but the military was looking for some way to secure America's vital economic and security interests in Europe without having to rely on occupation troops. So these ideas actually developed from people like Secretary of War Henry Stimson, Army Secretary Kenneth Royal, Navy Secretary and later Defense Secretary Jim Forrestal, who was really a hawk's hawk. But he defended the Marshall Plan aid program before Congress, saying it was, quote unquote, far less expensive than standing isolated and alone in an unfriendly world.
So that's really interesting. The military said we have to do this for our own national security reasons. And it reminds me of something, you know, you say in the book, the Marshall Plan is often described as unprecedented in a number of ways. So that's one of the ways, Ben. How else is the Marshall Plan unprecedented?
Well, it's not as if we hadn't tried massive financial aid before 1947. In fact, between 1945 and the time of Marshall's iconic speech at Harvard in June 1947, where he introduced the ideas that became the Marshall Plan, we spent about the same amount in aid as we did through the Marshall Plan. The big difference was that earlier aid was done through a UN relief organization called UNRWA. It was multilateral, and the United States had very little control over it. In this particular case, we were going to operate in very close collaboration with the recipient countries in Europe. And importantly, we were going to require them to cooperate to produce an economically and politically integrated Western Europe that would in many senses resemble the United States.
So that's also what's different. It isn't just, you know, here's some food. It's a whole sort of another layer of depth beyond that.
We made all this massive amount of aid, about $135 billion worth in current dollars, or in terms of our GDP, it was 1.1% of GDP. That would be over $800 billion today. We made it conditional on the West Europeans coming to us with an integrated plan for rehabilitation and recovery. That is, each nation was not going to be able to present us with a shopping list saying, we want our own steel industry, for example. They were going to have to come to the United States and say, we've done our homework. This is how we're going to manufacture steel most appropriately. This is how we're going to integrate our economies so we can efficiently produce steel in one place, agricultural products in another, and thereby help us to recover as quickly as possible.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So not just a shopping list, not just dropping gifts on people, but, you know, here's, we'll give you the money, but you need to have an integrated plan among all these squabbling nations, as you describe in the book, so that this money is well spent. And that's actually kind of an amusing chapter when you describe the competing interests and all the arguments that the Europeans had about this. I want to remind our listeners, Ben, that they can join us. The book is called The Marshall Plan, Dawn of the Cold War. The author is Ben Steele, Senior Fellow and Director of International Economics at the Council on Foreign Relations, also the author of The Battle of Bretton Woods. And Ben joins us from New York City. You can join us too, 1-800-892-6477. We'd love your questions and comments about The Marshall Plan, how it came to be, some of the untold stories about this plan, and how difficult it was to get it in place. Again, you can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. And Ben, here's an email that came in from Dan in Concord, who says, as Mr. Steele has written about in other books, FDR had a much closer relationship with his Treasury Secretary, whereas President Truman and the State Department gained more power. Whereas under President Truman, the State Department gained more power. Dan says, how critical were the specific personalities and the specific relationships to successfully developing and passing the Marshall Plan? Dan also wants to know, what lessons does this have for us today as we look to the situation in North Korea or Iran? I love this question, Dan, because your book does talk about a couple key people that really made this happen, Ben.
Yeah, it's a great question. With regard to FDR's Treasury Secretary, Henry Morgenthau, this was an old friend of FDR's from Hyde Park, New York. FDR was effectively his own Secretary of State, but he did listen to Henry Morgenthau. And so Morgenthau had enormous influence, not just over foreign economic policy, but foreign policy generally. And one of the most consequential policies that Morgenthau developed was the so-called Morgenthau Plan for the occupation of Germany, which he introduced and was approved by FDR in 1944. And the idea was to dismember and deindustrialize Germany, to effectively turn it into a pasture land so that it could never make war again. Fast forward to 1947, when Truman is now president and Marshall is Secretary of State. And this policy is leading to both moral and geostrategic disaster. There's mass starvation in Germany, which is not by any means self-sufficient agriculturally. And it's making it very difficult for the Americans to maintain law and order. And Stalin is basically licking his lips, thinking he's going to be able to take over Western Europe any day now. The personalities that Truman empowered were very, very important to the success of the Marshall Plan. For example, after Marshall's speech, Truman's main political advisor, Clark Clifford, recommended to him that the plan be called the Truman Plan. And Truman, who was very wise politically, laughed and said, anything going up before Congress, this is a hostile Republican Congress, bearing my name will just, quote unquote, twitch a few times, go belly up and die. But the worst Republican, he said, could not vote against a plan named after the general. And indeed, General Marshall's stature in Congress was exceptionally important to getting through the Marshall Aid legislation.
Yeah, he was kind of impeccable, wasn't he? Tell us a little bit more about George Marshall and how he was definitely more untouchable than the president.
Yes, Marshall was fundamentally apolitical, and this was truly important in terms of his reputation in Congress. He was, of course, rightly seen as the architect of our victory in World War II. He made very clear that he would never run for office, so this was not a man who was in any sense going to be competing with the political establishment in Washington. And this made it possible for Truman, who was in many senses seen as an illegitimate president by the Republican Congress. Marshall's presence, Marshall's stature, made it possible for Truman to get such a controversial aid package through the legislature. And I would emphasize the importance of one other critical individual, Republican Senator Arthur Vandenberg, who was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who was a critical bridge between the White House and Congress. And in fact, throughout the legislative process, which started in September of 1947, went through to passage in April 1948. He had many secret meetings, weekly secret meetings with Marshall to craft the package for selling this politically.
Well, and it was a tough sell, but they did get some help from key groups out in the rest of the country. Farmers, for example, who else helped
Absolutely.
Bolster support for this, Ben?
You know, this was called at the time a Marshall Plan to create the Marshall Plan. In other words, how are we going to get this legislation through when the populace really wants to be finished
sure.
with Europe? And so what the Truman administration did was to galvanize not just Congress, but the American public. Hundreds and hundreds of congressmen went on fact-finding missions to Europe in the fall of 1947 and came back convinced that the United States did indeed have to do something. But there were agricultural groups in the heartland of America. There were religious groups. There were labor groups. There were think tanks like mine, the Council on Foreign Relations, all involved in the public debate over this plan.
Well, and coming up, Ben, you mentioned Stalin licking his lips over the turmoil and starvation in Europe, thinking that that would provide him an opportunity to move in. So we'll definitely pick up on that after a short break. Dan, thank you for that email. We'll take more of your emails after a short break. It's exchange@nhpr.org if you want to chime into our conversation. exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477.
Spring is just about here, and Morning Edition is hitting the road. In our new weekly series, we're traveling across the Granite State to take you to new places and introduce you to new people.
Yeah, the moon looks very cinematic. What are we expecting to see tonight?
Yeah, people come here to see the alpacas.
Homebrewers starting out, how do you get from just whipping up batches in your basement to opening up your own tasting room?
Listen to Radio Field Trips, Morning Edition's new series about New Hampshire life and culture, Wednesday mornings from 5 to 9, on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy.
The great rubble heaps left by the war were soon diminished by an American investment in international friendship and goodwill, which also proved to be an effective economic weapon against spreading communism. the Marshall Plan.
Today, we're talking with author Ben Steele about the Marshall Plan. His new book is called The Marshall Plan, Dawn of the Cold War, and it details just how hard it was to get European partners to agree on the plan, especially the question of Germany. It also reveals new information about how the Soviets viewed the plan. Let's get your questions in about this. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And author Ben Steele joins us from New York City. And Ben, let's pick up on that, what we just heard in the clip, not only for humanitarian reasons, but also to stop the spread of communism. This was the big selling argument, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It was fundamental. If the Truman administration had tried to sell the Marshall Plan to Congress as purely a humanitarian initiative, it would never have succeeded.
And so how hard did they push this? Did they immediately start with this argument, or did they kind of start weaving it in as they went along, selling this plan slowly over the months?
That's a great question. If you go back to the spring and early summer of 1947, any time George Marshall or his deputy Dean Acheson would talk about the Marshall Plan, they would focus on the extreme hardship in Europe and how critical it was for the United States to intervene economically in order to aid these poor people. There was usually no mention whatsoever of the Soviet Union. For example, Marshall's iconic Harvard speech in June of 1947 does not mention the Soviet Union by name. In fact, Marshall makes it clear that the aid package is open to all European countries. Now, quite obviously, he doesn't want the Soviet Union trying to participate. He knows they would undermine the geopolitical aims of the Marshall Plan. And equally important, it would make it impossible for Congress to legislate it. So it was part of the State Department's strategy to get Stalin himself to reject American magnanimity.
Well, and that is a part of this whole history that I was less aware of, Ben. So I definitely want to talk to you about that. And let's hear a little bit of Secretary of State George Marshall. This is where he starts to make this argument that, hey, if we don't get in there and help Europe out, the Soviet Union will be quite ready to do it themselves. Here he describes to Congress the Soviet Union's attempts to undermine European support for the Marshall Plan.
Far from cooperating, the Soviet Union and the Communist parties have proclaimed their determined opposition to a plan for European economic recovery. Economic distress is to be employed to further political ends. There are many who accept the picture that I have just drawn, but who raise a further question. Why must the United States carry so great a load in helping Europe? The answer is simple. The United States is the only country in the world today which has the economic power and productivity to furnish the needed assistance.
Again, that's Secretary of State George Marshall testifying before Congress in January 1948 about the Marshall Plan. And that's what we're talking about today in the exchange. A new book gives a lot of new detail, new information about all the diplomatic maneuvering, how hard it was to get this thing on its way, working. There was debate in America, there was debate in Europe, and then there was the Soviet Union. Let's get your questions in. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So there he is, Ben, George Marshall, kind of saying what you said a minute ago. Stalin is licking his chops over this. He loves that Europe is in disarray, because then he can kind of move in. Was that really Stalin's feeling all along, or did he kind of come to that conclusion?
Well, first of all, that with regard to the clip you played from Marshall, once we get into the fall, Marshall's rhetoric changes dramatically.
Okay.
He's no longer concentrating on the hardship in Europe. He's concentrating on the geopolitics, because Senator Vandenberg makes it clear to him that there's no way he's getting this aid package through Congress without focusing on the main geostrategic issue, the spread of communism. Now, of course, the United States and the Soviet Union were, during the war, allies. But as Joseph Stalin wryly commented at the Tehran Allied War Leaders Conference in 1943, quote unquote, the best friendships are those founded on misunderstandings. And indeed, the misunderstandings between FDR and Stalin were profound. FDR believed or wanted to believe that after the war, the Soviets would effectively contain themselves. That is, they'd be satisfied with their newly expanded borders. And Stalin, for his part, believed that the Americans would go home after the war, just as they had after World War I. And that misunderstanding really broke down entirely as soon as the fighting stopped in Europe. By the time we get into 1946, Stalin is pressing new territorial claims in Turkey and Iran. He refuses to withdraw Soviet troops occupying Iran since the war under treaty. He only backs down when President Truman sends a military flotilla. But the watershed moment comes in February of 1947, when the British come to the State Department saying that they are bankrupt and they are withdrawing their 40,000 troops from Greece, where they are protecting the Greek government against communist insurgents. At that point, it becomes the fundamental objective of the State Department to prevent Stalin from moving in to the parts of the Mediterranean and Western Europe where economic and political chaos seems to be spreading.
So, and then another watershed, right, Ben? The Soviet takeover of Czechoslovakia. How does that affect the debate in the U.S. over whether we should do this Marshall Plan or not?
As you know, the subtitle of my book is Dawn of the Cold War, and I explain in the book that it's not until Marshall's speech that Stalin loses all hope for cooperation with the United States. The Marshall Plan really knocks him over. He's now realizing that the U.S. presence in Europe is not going to be rolled back, that Germany is going to be reindustrialized and made into the fulcrum of the Marshall Plan. That he considers to be a major security threat. And he also sees that the United States is going to pry loose try to pry loose some of his key satellite states in Central Europe, and in particular, Czechoslovakia. Czechoslovakia, after the war, had a legitimate coalition government, freely elected in 1946. Two-thirds of the cabinet were small-d democratic members. They were not communist. And even though Stalin made clear to them after Marshall's speech that they were not to participate in the Marshall Plan, the Democrats continued into the fall to express the hope that they would eventually be able to join. Finally, as we get into early 1948, Stalin decides that he's had enough of this. He cracks down on all of the remaining coalition governments in Central and Eastern Europe, and Czechoslovakia bears the brunt of it. He instigates a communist coup, a complete takeover in February of 1948. And this is actually a key development in terms of helping to pass the Marshall Aid legislation in Congress. This convinces many Republican members of Congress that they have to support the Marshall Plan in order to stop Stalin from spreading his influence into Western Europe.
Yeah, they say, wow, look at what Stalin's doing. He's serious. We better move in there. But what I learned from your book that I didn't know before, Ben, is that there was a point at which the Soviets might have actually been a part of the Marshall Plan, which today seems crazy.
Well, as I said earlier, Marshall did not indicate in his speech any limitations in terms of who could participate. And Stalin actually considered for a while trying to participate. In terms of economics, Stalin was very much a Marxist ideologue. And he believed that we had arrived at the final stage of capitalism and that the American economy faced imminent collapse. And the United States, in its own interest, was going to have to give Europe billions of dollars to bail out its own industry. And he figured that if he could get aid from the United States without any geopolitical conditions attached, he may as well do it. So he did consider for a while the possibility of participating. But once the Czechs and the polls in particular expressed undue enthusiasm for participating in the Marshall Plan despite American geopolitical conditions. Stalin did a 180 and really rang down the Iron Curtain.
Well, and it's interesting in the book, there's a lot of very clever diplomatic work, very crafty language, lots of personal contact, lots of late night meetings, probably some vodka drunk at those meetings. I was struck by the diplomatic fancy footwork. How much of the success of this Marshall Plan rested on the work of those sort of face-to-face diplomatic encounters?
They were critical. Right after Marshall's speech, the British Foreign Secretary Ernest Bevin and the French Foreign Minister Georges Bidault meet in Paris to map out their strategy for producing this consolidated European proposal to give to the State Department. And key to their strategy is to invite the Soviet Foreign Minister Vyacheslav Molotov to Paris to negotiate Soviet participation in the plan. But they are determined, as is the State Department, who are coordinating with them, to get Molotov so angry that he will storm out of the negotiations. So again, that the Soviets would bear responsibility for splitting Europe, not the United States or the Western Europeans. And indeed, that's precisely what happened. Stalin really took the bait.
Well, and you see the skill of these people, the way they use relationships and language. And it kind of made me wonder, Ben, if we still have this today or if communication is all online and, you know, who cares about the skills or lack thereof of that diplomatic attaché on the ground?
You know, the people who were in place at the time really did make a huge difference. It's not just General Marshall and his stature, but the people under him, Undersecretary Dean Acheson, famed Sovietologist George Kennan, who developed the geostrategy of containing the Soviet Union in 1946 and 1947, was a key architect. Will Clayton, the Undersecretary of State for Economic Affairs, he can really, in many senses, be considered the father of the European Union. It was Clayton who went off to Paris to bang heads among the 16 Marshall Aid recipients to force them to cooperate. The French, in particular, had to be brought into this kicking and screaming.
Well, and this relates to an email that Tom sent us. He says, can you ask your guests on the role of Dean Acheson? I believe Acheson was one of the unsung heroes in executing much of the post-war plan. So it sounds like you kind of answered Tom's question. Dean Acheson was hugely important.
Yes, he actually presented in Mississippi in May a sort of prelude to the Marshall Plan, an extremely important speech. He's sort of Marshall's warm-up band, as it were, to get the message out into the heartland that the United States is going to have to do something. So he's very important in terms of making it clear to the Truman, in particular, that the United States has to move away from the so-called Yalta-Potsdam framework for cooperation with the Soviets, because the Soviets are not going to cooperate. The Soviets are determined to drag Germany and Western Europe down into chaos. And Acheson, who wasn't by any means a natural cold warrior, in 1946, he was still looking for some mechanism to produce détente with the Soviet Union. But by 47, when he realizes the game Stalin's playing, he becomes a critical actor in the early Cold War. And he actually replaces Marshall as Secretary of State in 1949 and becomes instrumental in the creation of NATO in April of 1945, which was known in the State Department as a military ERP, European Recovery Program. So this becomes, in effect, the military escort for martial aid in Europe.
Well, and you hear something new every day. Ben, that's the first time I've heard Dean Acheson described as the warm-up band for the Marshall Plan. So I appreciate that. And thank you, Tom, for the email. You can send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org. exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So let's dive into the Europeans a little bit more, Ben. And you've made reference here and there that Clayton had to sort of bang heads and get people to sit down and say, okay, we've got this Marshall Plan, we want to help you out, but you guys need to decide how you are going to use this aid effectively. And the number one dispute that the Europeans had, Ben, is the German question.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. So what were the views on how Germany should be approached?
Well, the French, in fact, were almost as brutal in their occupation of their part of Germany. Of course, after the war, Germany was divided into four zones of occupation, one of which was a French zone. The French were about as brutal as the Soviets in terms of, for example, ripping up German industrial facilities to cart them off to France. France was determined to make sure that Germany would never again be a military threat to the country. And they were also quite interested in taking over German industry and making France into the dominant industrial power in Europe. So the French were really taken aback and deeply disturbed by the complete reversal in American occupation policy that it happened under the Truman administration. As I'd mentioned earlier, official American occupation policy after the war had been the so-called Morgenthau Plan to deindustrialize Germany, which the French were very happy with. And now the Americans are saying, no, 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 we're going to reindustrialize Western Germany as quickly as possible and make it into the industrial engine of this new integrated Western Europe. The French and the British in particular made clear to the United States that they could not participate in this vision, even with the prospect of enormous aid, this vision of an integrated Western Europe, because it would undermine their self-sufficiency. The United States was going to have to do more than provide economic aid. It was going to have to provide security guarantees. The French, for example, said, you know, what's going to happen if in 5 years' time the Germans cut off our coal supplies or the Soviets take over Western Germany and cut off our coal supplies? You, the United States, have to do more. And this was really the genesis of NATO. And as I explain in the book, NATO and the Marshall Plan really have to be viewed as a coherent whole, as the fundamental first components of the American strategy of containing the Soviet Union after the war.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You can see why France and others would want a pastoral Germany so it couldn't gin up the war machine again. We'll talk about that a little bit more after a short break. And then a couple more questions, including, as you say in the book, Ben, there are so many modern calls for a Marshall Plan for this, a Marshall Plan for that. So I'll definitely get your thoughts on that as well. You can send us an email if you'd like. Join our conversation, exchange@nhpr.org, or call 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup with host Peter Biello. This hour, a new book re-examines the Marshall Plan, a massive humanitarian and rebuilding effort for Europe after World War II. The book is called The Marshall Plan, Dawn of the Cold War. The author is Ben Steele. He joins us from New York City. And we're taking your questions and comments, too. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. What have you always wanted to know about the Marshall Plan? What is it about this giant effort that you've never quite understood? Again, email exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So, Ben, real interesting, before the break, you were talking about, you know, some of the very serious and understandable issues that Europeans had approaching this, whether Germany should be reindustrialized. My goodness, then they could just, you know, create another war machine. You can understand that fear. What were some of the other points of contention among the Europeans? Because you write that getting them to cooperate was proving more difficult than the Americans anticipated.
Well, we see it today in the way the European Union operates. There are constant squabbles over economic policy, over security policy, over the division of political powers. Just look at the past 10 years since the financial crisis, the dispute over Greece, what to do, whether to bail out Greece, whether Greece should leave the Eurozone. So they're going through all these issues back in the summer of 1947. For example, should Europe create a customs union? A customs union is an integrated economic area which will facilitate free trade not only within the Marshall Nations, but external trade outside the zone. This was an enormous source of contention, and in fact, the customs union, despite the fact that Will Clayton really pushed for it, didn't come into effect until 1968. There was the beginnings of the European Monetary Union in Paris in the summer of 1947. A few years later, in 1950, again with American prodding, a European Payments Union was instituted, which was underwritten by Marshall Aid, which allowed these countries who no longer had hard currency, that was dollars or gold with which to trade, in order to allow them to trade with each other without having to worry about whether they were going to get paid back, which, as you can imagine, was a particular concern when dealing with a heavily indebted Western Germany.
Well, I have to ask you about America's longtime best friend, Britain. You write that Britain brought to the conference on the Marshall Plan all sorts of problems. And I have to read this, Ben, because I laughed out loud. For Marshall, the British were demanding the impossible, wanting to benefit fully from a European program, while at the same time maintaining the position of not being wholly a European country. That is exactly the critique leveled at Britain today. They kind of feel,
absolutely,
people on the continent feel like Britain wants the goodies of being allied with the EU without the costs. I just was really struck by that. The more things change, the more they stay the same.
70 years after the Marshall Plan, of course, Britain is exiting the European Union. But it was the United States in 1947 who forced the British into a European project in the first place, and they were none too happy about it. Britain at the time, despite the fact that it was nearly bankrupt, saw itself as an imperial power, and it also saw itself as having a special relationship with the United States, and this, quite frankly, was a relationship that the State Department didn't recognize.
Well, and Truman writes to his sister, the British have turned out to be our problem children now. So it's kind of amusing, especially given what's going on now with Brexit and so forth, as you mentioned. You know, Ben, I got to ask you this. There's been a lot written about the Marshall Plan. How is your book different?
Well, as you see from the subtitle of my book, I emphasize the Cold War element of the story. And this is based on tens of thousands of pages of Soviet-era archival documents I got back from Moscow. I was really struck by the depth of Stalin's concerns about the Marshall Plan and what it meant for the future of American economic, political, and eventually military re-engagement with Europe. As I make clear in the book, it's not until Marshall's speech in June of 1947 that both the United States and the Soviet Union write off any prospect for further cooperation. For example, I discovered that in May of 1947, just before Marshall's speech, Stalin orders a Soviet negotiating delegation to reach agreement with the Americans on the creation of an interim unified government in Korea. So he's willing to cooperate with the Americans outside of Europe in order to hone in on what he considers to be the ultimate prize, and that is taking over Germany.
So that's interesting. And we forget that for that brief moment between 45 and 47, there is a thought on both sides of, you know, quote unquote, one world and we can cooperate and so forth. And then when the Marshall Plan comes out, that kind of melts.
Yeah. Chip Bolin, who is a Sovietologist in the State Department, produces a very stark memorandum in August of 1947, in which he says explicitly that this one world vision that the FDR administration backed was finished. There was now, in fact, two worlds, a democratic capitalist world being led by the United States, represented in Europe by the 16 Marshall countries. And then there was the slave world, the Soviet Union and its satellites in Central and Eastern Europe.
Got about 10 more minutes to get your questions and comments in. So send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We're talking about the Marshall Plan today, including some new information about how this plan came to be. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Or again, send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And here's one that came in from Dennis in Barrington that I'd like to share with you, Ben. Dennis says, most would agree that following our military success in Iraq, the post-war effort was not successful. What were the significant differences that contributed to the success of the post-World War II situation and the struggle following the Iraq War? Was Iraq an opportunity missed or doomed from the beginning? Dennis, thank you so much, because this comes up in the book, Ben. You say, nowadays still we're saying, let's do a Marshall Plan for this. Let's do a Marshall Plan for that.
April was the 70th anniversary of the Marshall Plan, and perhaps its most enduring legacy is the endless desire to repeat it.
Yeah.
In the past 5 years alone, we've had impassioned calls for new Marshall Plans in Ukraine, in Greece, in Southern Europe, in North Africa, in Gaza, and most recently in Syria. But the old original one has never been replicated or even badly imitated. That doesn't mean we haven't tried massive reconstruction aid as a political tool. Let's take the cases of Iraq and Afghanistan. We have actually spent over $200 billion on reconstruction aid alone in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, to put that in historical perspective, that is over 50% more than the totality of Marshall aid in current dollars. So we've done more than a Marshall Plan in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we have nothing to show for it economically and politically. Now, of course, there are many differences between Iraq and Afghanistan on today, on the one hand, and Western Europe in 1947. But the key difference is the lack of internal and external security in Iraq and Afghanistan. Both countries have been besieged with internal strife, opponents internally, ISIS, for example, the Taliban externally. We've been competing against other regional actors such as Iran, who don't share our interest. So this lack of security has been fundamental in terms of making it impossible for us to achieve our geopolitical aims. Whereas in the case of Western Europe, after World War II, through the creation of NATO, we were able to create this vital security environment. And that's what led to the rapid new investment, private investment that came into Europe after World War II that was so fundamental to Europe's recovery. It wasn't just American aid, however significant that might have been, but the revival of economic confidence on the ground in Western Europe, because the Americans made clear that they were not going home this time.
Well, it's interesting because, and I really appreciate the question, Dennis, because it comes up a lot. So thank you. You know, as you were talking, Ben, you said, you know, internal strife, externally, Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, have people working at cross purposes with the U.S. But that does, there are some parallels to what you have described in Europe. And you talked about the reason the Marshall Plan was successful is because of NATO, and it provided security. But the U.S. has put a lot of money into securing Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, many American lives have been lost in those efforts. So, again, I just kind of wonder what the difference is. I appreciate the question from Dennis.
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, geography was really our friend after World War II. The Soviets, of course, did not occupy any part of Western Europe. And in order to get to Paris or Rome, they would have had to send tanks through territory that we were capable of defending. But I should just emphasize, I think this is really important, that although we remember the Marshall Plan today as being visionary, it was also extremely hard-headed. That is, if we had defined success as bringing, say, Czechoslovakia and Poland into the Marshall Plan, we wouldn't view the Marshall Plan today as being a success because we would have had to go to war with the Soviet Union in order to achieve that. And we didn't have the forces on the ground to ensure success. And it was indeed one of the fundamental aims of the Marshall Plan to secure America's vital economic and security interests in Europe without having to go back to war.
Was there ever discussed a Marshall Plan for Japan, Ben?
There was a lot of discussion about spreading the thinking behind the Marshall Plan, not just to Japan, but to China. Of course, that's a story in its own right, quote unquote, who lost China. And in fact, General Marshall had a failed diplomatic mission to reconcile the nationalists and communists in China in 1946. But although we didn't in the end have an official Marshall Plan for the Asia Pacific, there is no doubt that we took some of the same ideas that we applied in Europe and brought them to the Asia Pacific. For example, the idea of turning Germany into a democratic capitalist ally. This was extraordinarily ambitious. We pursued the exact same posture toward Japan, that we were somehow going to turn Japan into a long-term ally of the United States. And indeed, Japanese cooperation with the United States proved critical in the Korean War a few years later.
Well, you write, Ben, that, quote, as with all legends, the Marshall Plan has its fair share of contrarians. Who are they and what do they say?
Well, it was only many decades after the Marshall Plan that economists started looking at the plan skeptically and saying, well, really, did it make all that difference? Might there not have been other things that were going on? And by far the most influential of these economist critics is a British economic historian who wrote mainly in the 1980s named Alan Millward. And Millward was really a staunch opponent of the Keynesian approach behind many of the details of how Marshall Aid worked. And he argued that the Marshall countries would have recovered almost as quickly without the Marshall Aid, and that in many ways the recovery would have been more effective in terms of not entrenching discredited socialist policies had we not had the aid. And as I explained in the book, there are deep flaws in this analysis. Millward argues, for example, that if these countries had just sucked it up and agreed to maintain their food consumption levels what they were in 1946, that they would have had sufficient resources to import vital supplies and regenerate their economies. As I show in the book, his calculations are faulty. Some of his logic is faulty. For example, he argues that a deeper and more rapid Dutch integration with the German economy could as I explained in the book, without the Marshall Plan, there is no Western Germany. There is no West German state. And no one would have cooperated with Germany without American security guarantees.
Well, so that's kind of the answer to my last question for you, Ben. I mean, what would the world have looked like without the Marshall Plan? We'll never know, but we can speculate.
Well, two things I would suggest. First of all, there would be no European Union and no NATO today without the Marshall Plan. It's really remarkable to consider, stepping back from the Marshall Plan, looking at this whole period, how virtually every institution that we associate today with the post-war liberal order was created by the United States in just a few short years after World War II. The United Nations, the IMF, the World Bank, NATO, and the predecessor organizations to the European Union and the World Trade Organization, all created by the United States between 1945 and 1949. And as I explained, two of these institutions would almost certainly not exist had it not been for the geostrategy of the Marshall Plan.
Well, the book is called The Marshall Plan, Dawn of the Cold War. The author is Ben Steele. Ben, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
We wish to say goodbye today on The Exchange, and a big thanks to our intern, Marissa DeAngelis. Best wishes to you, Marissa. Good luck as you graduate and start your first job. We'll miss you. Thanks for all the help. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.